We all know you, if not having met you by repute, our wonderful teacher. What we are going to do today, as everybody knows, what we've asked for some teaching on is on the Heart Sutra. So Flint is going to talk for an hour or thereabouts, a certain period of time, and then invite questions. And before we have the questions, I'll just briefly go over how we'll manage the questions, all the stuff about putting up your hand and things, so everybody's really clear. So over to you, Flint.
So Kate, I'm going to have to stop just for 1 second, and because I have to take a phone call.
That's fine. Okay.
Yes, hello.
So, shall I sing a song while we're waiting, or happy day?
Summer is a coming in. Loudly sing cuckoo.
It's not on David's agenda what to do when Flint's on a phone call. So I don't know.
I don't know, but I put the spotlight on you, Kate, so you're now.
Yeah, I knew this would be the perfect time. And I tell you why it happened when it did. We're getting a new vehicle. But in order to receive a vehicle on this island, it has to be shipped on the barge. And it's arriving today, and I knew they would call me to tell me what time to come, of course. But I had to receive the calls. Something very practical. Very practical. And let me ask a question. When you were sitting and enjoying some of your practice together this morning, did you read together or chant the Heart Sutra?
The answer is not today.
Okay.
But what we have done in the previous meetings, we have done.
Okay. And I assume that you typically will utilize the Thich Nhat Hanh version, the translation that you sent me?
I think one time we used the Thich Nhat Hanh version, and the other we used the San Francisco Zen Center version.
Okay, great. So the only, the one of the three that I've sent you that you've not sort of spoken out loud or read was the Kaz Ta-Nehisi and Joan Halifax version. Good. And I say this as a joke. I assume you haven't chanted it in Japanese. No. It's actually quite lovely. And where I want to start, because it's actually where I started. When I began practicing many, many years ago at the San Francisco Zen Center, primarily the most formal place I was practicing, we would do the Heart Sutra in Japanese in the morning service every day. So you'd hear the person who's called the Kokyo, it's sort of like the cantor, offer the invitation when it was time to chant. And they'd say, Maka Hanya Haramita Shingyo. And that's the invitation to chant the Maka Haramita Shingyo, the Wisdom Beyond Wisdom Heart Sutra in Japanese. And then they would start with the Mokugyo little sound, and you start Kanji Zaibo Satyo Jin Hanya Hara. And it goes on in Japanese. It's actually quite lovely. And it has a beautiful feeling, even though you don't know what the hell they're saying. You don't understand what's going on. But it starts to get into your body and to your bones in some way. And this is, of course, what we're interested in practice, is for these teachings to penetrate us. I was also curious, and I might have to get some of your voices here, and also Kate or some others. Why did you want to actually learn more about the Heart Sutra?
Can say that I wanted to learn more about the Heart Sutra because it seemed to be so important in Mahayana Buddhism and in Zen. And the first few times I've read it, it made absolutely no sense to me at all.
Sure.
Yeah. I think that was me, and Sally, you asked to have it as well, didn't you?
I can't remember that, but I am certainly interested in learning more about it because it's quite hard to get any sense out of it. Well, there is a sense, but you know, I'm never very comfortable with the word emptiness, so I was sort of interested in what you'll talk to us, how you'll talk to us about that.
Yeah, it's something that, more than the Japanese, of course, when you can't understand anything, but when it's in English, sometimes it feels as if you don't understand very much more, actually. But there's something that it's speaking to. So, and I'm assuming that those of you that have come on to this precious time we have today also have some curiosity about this, or you wouldn't be here. I found a very interesting small statement by the American writer George Leonard, who has died, but he was a writer, some of you may know, was an editor for some of the more popular periodicals in the United States, but also a writer in the Human Potential Movement in the 70s and 80s. And these are his words. He says, "At the heart of each of us, whatever our imperfections, there exists a silent pulse of perfect rhythm, a complex of wave forms and resonances, which is absolutely individual and unique, and yet which connects us with everything in the universe. The act of getting in touch with this pulse can transform our personal experience in some ways, which then also alters the world around us." And it's this kind of pulse through which the Heart Sutra touches us and moves us, and which the sound carries us forward, that I want to explore a little bit today. Because the Heart Sutra is probably one of the most universally chanted pieces in all of Buddhism, whatever the sort of flavor or strain or lineage, you could probably assume that if you began to read or chant the Heart Sutra, someone else somewhere in the world is also chanting with you. It's as if it's a chant that never stops, because, you know, here we are in these different time zones. It's 20 minutes until 9 in the morning for me, and in the evening for you. But in various temples and homes and personal places of practice, someone is probably chanting this all around, all the time. So there's a universality there, and this is part of this pulse that moves through the universe in these teachings. I'm getting a little echo somewhere. The most compact way of thinking about the Heart Sutra is that it's telling us that nothing is certain and everything is free. Nothing is certain and everything is free. And in fact, Kate, you know, you mentioned that key word that shows up, emptiness, which curiously, in the third translation that I gave you from Akaz and Joan Halifax, they substitute the word boundless for emptiness. Maybe you've seen that. I see you shaking your head that you've noticed. It lands differently, doesn't it? Because in Chinese, the word that you might translate as shunyata, which is the Sanskrit, the primary word that we translate as emptiness, the character in Chinese is almost the same character as the character for the sky. All dharmas are empty like the sky is empty. Blue, beautiful, expansive, always ready to receive a bird or the wind or the cloud, the sun, the moon, an airplane, a storm. So the emptiness of the Heart Sutra isn't the emptiness of despair or nothingness. It's the emptiness of all limitation and boundary. It's open and it's released. Nothing is certain, everything is free. Because, and this is a universal teaching, which we know from Buddhism, when we're bound in our own skin and others are bound in theirs, then we have to defend ourselves and protect this otherness and this boundedness. And when I place myself among others, like we're doing today, and possibly open our minds and our hearts and our time and our senses to each other, it's important to do so carefully, which is also hard work. Because it's quite easy to be hurt or opposed by another or thwarted by others, if you haven't noticed politically. And every other way, even in one's own family and friends. But then, when there's openness, and I began to soften that boundary between myself and others, when it turns out that in some ways I realize myself, I really am the others, and the others are me, then love and connection are quite natural and quite easy. And this is the freedom of boundedness that the Prajnaparamita Sutras and the Heart Sutra begins to point to. The inside of the Prajnaparamita, and the Prajnaparamita is a larger term, the wisdom teachings of the Mahayana within which the Heart Sutra falls. The inside of the Prajnaparamita, the perfection of wisdom as taught in the Heart Sutra, is thought of as the ultimate truth. From a Buddhist perspective at least, transcending all conventional truths or knowledge. And it's also thought of as the highest vision of the Buddhist teachings. So in this way, it's pretty interesting and pretty important. I don't want to go into a lot of history. I don't think it's that interesting, and you can read about it if you'd like. And I will also, I didn't include, but I will, for... resources, if you're curious about study or reading, and things that I drew from in reviewing what we're talking about today. But I will say just briefly, you know, historically there are what you might think of as the original teachings of the Buddha, which include, you know, the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, the Twelvefold Chain, is sort of the basic Theravadan teachings and from the Pali. And then there's Buddhist philosophy, the Abhidharma of the Theravada, the sutras and their commentaries, which came after and go beyond just the original Buddha's teachings. So there's the original teachings, the philosophy, and then there's also what you think of as like the Buddhist religion. And this is a pluralistic group of traditions that go throughout the East, East Asia. And actually, if you think about it historically, Buddhism, as we use that term, was a unitary designation that was really given to us by Christian missionaries in the late 19th century that wouldn't be spoken of, actually, in some of the countries of origin. But it's also said that this Buddhism takes the shape of the vessel into which it's poured. So that in northern India, it looked a certain way. And in Tibet and Nepal, another way. In China, in Vietnam, in Korea and Japan, and now in Western countries, it takes those forms and shapes them differently depending on the culture. Hopefully, ideally, with the central teachings being still in place, still having the vitality and aliveness that the Buddha, in the way the Buddha first taught them, in which the writers of the sutras and the commentators try to express it, and the devotion that religious practitioners bring to it. So the Heart Sutra and the Prajnaparamita teachings are kind of a bridge really between the philosophy and the religion part. So it kind of rests in there. And there are essentially five key words that the Buddha used in those original teachings, five words of the Buddha which kind of characterize or summarize his teachings. And the four basic ones, and you don't need to know the translations so much, anatta, anicca, dukkha, nirvana, no self, impermanence, anguish or suffering, and transcendence of anguish or suffering. That's four. The, you know, impermanence being kind of the basic, anatta or no self or dependent origination, dukkha, anguish, and nirvana, transcendence. Those are the four. But the fifth, emptiness or shunyata, it's with the inclusion of that word that the Mahayana begins to kind of set itself apart from the more orthodox earlier schools. And in some ways, if you have studied some of these things, anatta or no self was foundational in those early schools, and shunyata was used as a synonym. It was the same kind of thing. No self and emptiness were kind of used similarly. But later on, it became clear that anatta was a term that spoke about the individual consciousness and release. And the Mahayana invention was to postulate shunyata as an essential, not personal, emptiness of the phenomenal world, including a person's heart and mind. So just a little kind of history there and a little way of situating the teachings within the larger Buddhist context. Because shunyata, and I'm using the classical word because in some ways it's quite difficult to translate, it's an insight or a bit of wisdom that's only met or touched in some ways wordless intuition. In the Mahayana understanding, it's through this intuitive, wordless intuition that one can realize the true nature of the phenomenal world in which we're embedded. And in doing so, begin to let go of clinging and to reach, and you hear it in Thich Nhat Hanh's translation, the other shore of liberation. Now, Nagarjuna, which I may come back to a little bit, was a scholar who much later wrote really powerfully about the middle way, which is another essential teaching of the Buddha. The way between being and non-being, between existence and nihilism. He said it's easy to get caught in this kind of view and this kind of view. And his way of writing was quite remarkable. And if you think the Heart Sutra is a little difficult, try reading his original. But he held that underneath the absence of all substances and qualities or essential characteristics of this contingent, ever-changing world, there does remain an ultimate reality. But that ultimate reality is that of dependent origination. So in a way, shunyata doesn't mean complete nothingness, but it's serenely vibrant, which moves us from non-being to a wondrous being. It's an opening. And I thought about you, David, with your interest in science, because in the same piece from George Leonard, in which I brought that beautiful quote in the beginning, he was reflecting on the work of John Bell and Werner Heisenberg and John Wheeler and some of those physicists, and here's his quotation. He said, "A strange place in this world of the new physics, a world of ultimate connectedness, where consciousness, it might be said that the vastness of space, the nuclear conflagration of stars, the explosions of galaxies, are simply mechanisms for producing the first glimmer of awareness in your baby's eyes." So it's a bit of a poetic, beautiful image of saying this vastness is expressed and known in this beautiful, subtle, personal connectedness. And so the main purpose of the Heart Sutra is to express, or maybe explain, I don't know, the core practices of Mahayana Buddhism, which, as the title suggests, is the realization of this wisdom, which goes beyond wisdom. It's not just a wisdom teaching, it's a wisdom beyond wisdom teaching. And the word that's often used to kind of point to the this wordless intuitive insight that one comes to through practice is sometimes realization. But realization is nothing but actualization. It's that everything about the sutra is not mere intellectual investigation, even though, boy, it seems like it when we talk about it this way, but practice through meditation. And the sutra touches on three themes, and this is how we're going to approach it then. The invocation of the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara in the beginning, there's an invocation. Then the body of the text is the examination of everything in the light of shunyata, or this emptiness or boundlessness that we're talking about. And then the recitation of the mantra at the end. So this is the kind of structure of the presentation. So that seemed clear enough. You kind of oriented. So we have a little bit of history, a little bit of kind of orientation, and this is how we're going to look at the structure of things. Because I don't want this to get too. I'll look back at your little squares, and everyone will be sleeping if it's too too intellectual. And if you know, ideally, if we were in the same room, there would be a little more ease of conversation as we go along, which I kind of wish there was, but. If you're willing to tolerate my going on a little more. Is that okay? Should I go forward, or are there questions now that people, you want to ask anything now? Is it okay? Because I don't want to, if you get confused or there's something that stops you, it's hard to go on. But I'm seeing thumbs up. Should I go forward? Okay. So we'll start with the invocation of Avalokiteshvara. Okay? And I think most people know that Avalokiteshvara is the archetypal bodhisattva, the figure who represents in an archetypal way the essence of compassion. In China, this became Kuan Yin. In Japan, you see this figure as Kanon or Kanzeon. So they're just different expressions in different cultures. Literally, in the basis of that word, Avalokiteshvara, it's kind of fun to say, you know. It's the translation would be the one who hears the cries of the world. So it's this deeply receptive and responsive energy that meets whatever suffering or difficulty there is. And there's a curious thing. In all of the Prajnaparamita texts on the Mahayana, the Heart Sutra is the only text where Avalokiteshvara appears in the Prajnaparamita text. And it's kind of a curious thing. Here's a text that is completely dedicated to the teachings of shunyata or emptiness. And there's absolutely no reference to compassion in it. So it seems like a wisdom teaching. That's what it says, the wisdom beyond wisdom. And here it's being taught by Avalokiteshvara. So this should get your attention. Why would, even from a rhetorical point of view, the Bodhisattva of compassion be the ultimate teacher of the wisdom beyond wisdom teachings? It's not Manjushri teaching, not the Buddha teaching. It's Avalokiteshvara speaking. Now, I'll say more about this, but the absence of the theme of compassion is kind of countered in it implicitly by the fact that the wisdom essential to the realization of Buddhahood is being proclaimed here by a bodhisattva who is the embodiment of compassion. So it's an interesting technique here. And even more so, this is the presence of Shariputra, the other figure in the that's mentioned, is equally important. Because in the Pali scripture, Shariputra is considered like the top guy when it comes to wisdom. He's the wisest disciple of the Buddha. His historical role as the founder of the Abhidharma is decisive in early Buddhism. So you think like this is the primary scholar, the great wisdom person. And here, in this, I'll call it a story in a way, in the invocation, he's presented as perplexed and unable to understand the deeper meaning of the Shunyata teachings, just like Kate. He's like, what? So once again, from a rhetorical point of view and a storytelling point of view, it's very interesting. The great wisdom teachings that go beyond all are being taught by the Bodhisattva of compassion. And who is she or he, often she, teaching to? Shariputra, who's supposed to know all this stuff. He's supposed to be the great wisdom teacher. So the assertion here is that this highest form of wisdom, the Prajnaparamita, in which all the units of our experience are ultimately empty. It's basically saying the Abhidharma, the old text, the foundational text on the Buddhist philosophy, end at wisdom, and this goes beyond it. The Heart Sutra and the Prajnaparamita step beyond what Shariputra taught, beyond the original wisdom teachings. And so it, in some ways, deconstructs the previous Abhidharma understanding of the Dharmas and articulates a new one. But that's way beyond what we're going to talk about today. That's very academic and philosophical. But I did want you to get the idea of what a fascinating beginning this invocation is, because it sets the stage in a way that is completely unique among all the teachings of the Prajnaparamita. And this Bodhisattva, Avalokiteshvara, is described in the very first line as the one who moves through the deep course of realizing this wisdom beyond wisdom. Thus, it implies that wisdom is not separated from loving kindness or compassion. Because right away, the Bodhisattva of compassion is the one who is realizing these things. In the, just see if I can get to my, in the Thich Nhat Hanh version that you have read before, it says, Avalokiteshvara, while practicing deeply, with the insight that brings us to the other shore, suddenly discovered that all of the five skandhas are equally empty, and with this realization, overcame all ill being. San Francisco says, Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, when deeply practicing Prajnaparamita, clearly saw that all five aggregates are empty and thus relieved all suffering. And the third one, moving through the deep course of realizing wisdom beyond wisdom, sees that all five streams of the body, heart, and mind are without boundary and therefore free from anguish. So, beginning to see that this compassion teacher is teaching the so-called wisdom teacher about the wisdom that goes beyond wisdom, and it kind of turns out to be compassion, this wisdom beyond wisdom. It's a very interesting thing. So according to the sutra, it's through practicing wisdom beyond wisdom, what Avalokiteshvara is immersed in here. It's through practicing wisdom beyond wisdom that we become free. And in understanding, reciting, and practicing this principle of freedom, which the Heart Sutra gives us a form for, many others can experience liberation or freedom from anguish. Now, the emptiness teachings of the Heart Sutra, we're going to get into Shunyata a little bit here, but I want to say a little bit more about compassion, because this is such a fascinating thing, I think. The emptiness teachings of the Heart Sutra seem really philosophical, and even more than that, kind of dour. Why is this necessary for compassion? Well, we know that emptiness and compassion go hand in hand. That wisdom, if you see the world clearly and deeply with the true eye of wisdom, without your personal filter so much, you see that there's a lot of difficulty. People are struggling. And if you are cultivating compassion, which is a willingness to look and stay and meet those things, then that compassionate capacity increases. The more you stay, the deeper you can look with wisdom and meeting the suffering. So wisdom and compassion are supporting each other. But if compassion is just a transactional thing, like I'm going to help you, me over here, being compassionate to you over there, this is way too, clunky and difficult. It isn't that transactional. If I'm going to be responsible to receive your suffering and maybe do something about it, and if I'm going to make this kind of compassion the cornerstone of my practice life, or even religious life, if you want to call it that, I'm going to be exhausted. This is not sustainable. Me trying to help everything and everybody, because it's not really help. But if I see the boundarylessness, the infinite, inconceivable, contingent fullness of me and you, and recognize that my suffering and your suffering are one suffering. There's the suffering. And that suffering is empty of separation, weightiness, ultimate tragedy. Then I can do it. If I can be boundless compassion, then I can be loving without limit. Now, this perspective sounds pretty lofty, doesn't it? It sounds like a big challenge. And living this kind of teaching takes time and effort, a lot of practice. Maybe, I don't know, maybe we never really arrive at it completely, but it is a joyful, heartfelt path worth treading. And that's what we're doing today. That's why we're together. But that view, this ultimate wisdom beyond wisdom view, is actually one-sided, because relative compassion, like human warmth and practical emotional support that we give each other, completes the picture. Absolute compassion makes it possible for us to sustain, even sustain joyfully, the endless work of supporting and helping. But relative compassion helps us roll up our sleeves and grounds our broad view of life's empty nature in heart connection and everyday engagement with each other. Either view by itself would be impossible. If we stay with the absolute, it's too lofty, nobody gets helped. If we stay in the relative view, we burn out because it's too hard. But together, it makes a wonderfully connected and sustainable life, and that's the stepping beyond. That's the wisdom beyond wisdom that allows for this kind of compassionate life. So the rewinding back to the Buddha's original proposal for liberation from suffering, it starts out simple enough. Understand the true nature of phenomena. Just that. Understand the true nature of phenomena, which is what we're talking about, including this thing that we call a self. And then don't cling to it. And the non-clinging will eventually lead to a serenity and some contentment and even maybe some joy in life. So that's the invocation. That's Avalokiteshvara showing up and being our teacher. The Bodhisattva of compassion teaching us wisdom beyond wisdom. So now let's go even further in Shunyata. Is there anything you wanted to say or ask about that bit right off? I just thought it was fascinating, the way it's situated, and that we have this teacher that we didn't expect. So we're going to go into the body of the sutra now, the part where we usually stumble and get tripped up, considering everything as shunyata. Now, you know, the sutra includes a bunch of lists, and those lists are characteristic of the Indian subcontinent. I forgot what you call it, something different. Their way of thinking and their philosophy, where they make lists. You know, there's the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, the Twelvefold Chain, the Seven Factors of Enlightenment, the on and on and on. And the five skandhas, which is a key, because right in the beginning, Avalokiteshvara, who's practicing Prajnaparamita, says, oh, all five skandhas are empty. And the skandhas are these streams, or sometimes heaps, it's called, of body, heart, and mind. They're all flowing together, and they are a rupa, or form, that's the body, that's the first one, material things that have shape and color, stuff, form. And then the other four are mental functions. So there's form, that's the beginning, then feelings, or sometimes it's called sensations, vedana. This is, you know, when you encounter something, we receive sensory stimulation, which may be pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. So this is just the our form meets the world and as some sort of response. Third is perceptions, samjna in Sanskrit. That's to receive these sensations, begins to create images and representations in the mind. So you're in a body, you turn on the computer, you try to get on Zoom, light energy comes in, it's like, oh boy, another session, or oh good, we're going to get to be together, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And then as soon as that happened, perceptions begins to create representations in the mind. And it all happens like that. Inclinations is the next one. This is impulse, or sometimes called formations, samskaras. And here's where will or volition comes in to mental formations. We begin to have a sense of agency and that there's this acting on that. And then the final one is called consciousness, or sometimes discernment, vijnana. That's based on all the above. It's the object of our awareness is recognized and judgments begin to form. In other words, now there's a whole self over here with a whole internal world. So a body, simple recognition through our sensations, perceiving and beginning to shape them, inclinations, and then mental and consciousness itself. We're creating a being. And what Avalokiteshvara says right in the beginning is, guess what? These six modes are empty. So are the sense organs and the six senses and the six self-sense consciousness and the Four Noble Truths. As you go through the sutra, it's gonna say all of these things aren't actually what you think they are. There are no essences, only processes. There are no essences, only processes. There are no essences, he says for the third time, only processes. The ceaseless, contingent change at the core of the universe. So shunyata is a dynamic pattern rather than an entity. And this is what Avalokiteshvara is saying in the very beginning. He says, oh, Shariputra, you want to understand the wisdom that goes beyond wisdom? I'm going to show you how every single thing that you describe in the Abhidharma is a dynamic pattern, not an entity, is a process and has no essence. And there's another thing here. And Kate, I'm remembering your question in the beginning about emptiness being difficult. There's a real difference between form being empty, because that almost sounds like, you know, like you have a little box and you open it, there's nothing in there. There's a difference between form being empty and what it says in the Heart Sutra, a form being emptiness. It doesn't say form is empty. Form is emptiness expressing itself. And what is form empty of? Individuality. Empty of separateness. Form is emptiness. Form is a way that one can see that everything is interdependent. And emptiness is form. How do you know emptiness of individuality? You can see form. Because it's this contingent process, no essences. So the Heart Sutra is claiming in a way that in the midst of all phenomena where everything's changing, the reality of boundless flow and processes continues, and this is not going to change, and the ultimate reality both encompasses all this change and is free of all this change and its manifestations. So, we know from going back to physics, you know, we don't need to get into some of the specifics, but Bell's theorem says, and Heisenberg also formulated the uncertainty principle, that if you're going to observe something, the observation changes it. Anything even with objects that are far apart. And so the same thing is true of meditation. In the deepest experience of meditation, the object of our consciousness is embedded in the observing consciousness. And the two of them fuse together by the energy of shunyata, emptiness, but out of which both also emerge. It gets to be a little convoluted, kind of like wave and particle stuff. So let's look just for a second. I'll come back to the boundlessness at, hopefully you have your copies of the sutras in front of you or somewhere where you can look at them. And let's look at the, since you're less familiar with it, it'll be interesting. Let's look at the Kaz Ta-Nehisi and Joan Halifax version. We start with the invocation, Avalokiteshvara, who helps all to awaken, moves in the deep course of realizing wisdom beyond wisdom, realizing this greater wisdom, and sees that all five streams, body, heart, and mind, are without boundary. And this realization frees everyone from anguish. This was the realization that Avalokiteshvara had. That's what we've just described. So Avalokiteshvara says, oh, Shariputra, the one who listens to the teachings of the Buddha, oh, Shariputra, form is not separate from boundlessness. Boundlessness is not separate from form. Form is boundlessness. Boundlessness is form. And feelings, perceptions, inclination, and discernment are also like this, the skandhas that we just talked about. O Shariputra, boundlessness is the nature of all things. It neither arises nor perishes, neither stains nor purifies, neither increases nor decreases. Boundlessness is not limited by form, nor by feelings, perceptions, inclinations, or discernment. So as you go through that first portion of the Heart Sutra, we're hearing these teachings, that everything that we take to be solid, everything that we see as maybe part of me and you, isn't exactly like we think it is. It's here, and it's happening, and it's what we attend to, but it's not real in the way we think it is. And when we take it as such, we suffer, because it causes the separation and the breakdown of compassion. If we understand that form, anything you see is an expression of boundlessness, is an expression of emptiness, empty of, emptiness, shunyata, is empty of individuality, therefore it's boundless. So in that way, when you hear the word empty in the Heart Sutra, it's shorthand for empty of an individual self-identifying nature. So not only is it not a void, it's like fullness of everything. It's boundless. And Avalokiteshvara is saying, and everything we take as solid in us is the same way. And then it goes on to begin to name the things that in the Abhidharma would be the lists of the things that we would take as solid. Its boundlessness, this wisdom beyond wisdom, is free of eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, mind. Boundlessness isn't dependent on what you see, hear, smell, taste, touch. Those things come out of the freedom. They don't define it. And then the object of our senses is also free of them. Sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, and any object of mind. And the sensory realms is free of sensory realms, including the realm of the mind. It's free of ignorance and the end of ignorance. Now, wait a minute. Now there's, it's kind of a funny one, isn't it? You'd expect to say, okay, here's a teaching that's going to end ignorance. But wait a minute, it's also free of the end of ignorance? This is where it takes us to wisdom beyond wisdom. We can let go of the way that we ordinarily attach to things and make our world and realize a larger perspective. And that larger perspective that we open to is stunning and vibrant and beautiful and inconceivable in some ways, but realizable. And it's easy to want to actually begin to cling to that, to cling to nirvana. And wisdom, beyond wisdom, says, and you don't even cling to that, you go beyond that. You're free of the end of ignorance. You're free of what you realize. Otherwise, it would be a new object. It'd be a new thing you had. And that's one of the things that you have to really be careful about in thinking about wakefulness, liberation, enlightenment, whatever you want to call it, as if we begin to conceive of it as a thing you could create and then have. And these teachings are saying, nothing is like that. Nothing. There aren't created things that you can then have. If you go further, boundlessness is free of old age and death. It's free of the end of old age and death. It's free of suffering, arising, cessation, the path. It's free of wisdom and attainment. It's like pulling the rug out from everything. And then Avalokiteshvara says, being free of attainment, those who help all to awaken, that's bodhisattvas, abide in the realization of wisdom beyond wisdom and live in an unhindered mind. Once you give up on the fact that you're going to get something that you can create and that you think you can have, that your meditation was going to get you, that your practice is going to provide for you, once you let go of that, being free of attainment, because you're stepping into the bodhisattva path, those who help all to awaken, once you let go of it all, then you abide in the realization beyond wisdom and live in an unhindered mind. Without hindrance, the mind has no fear, it says. Free from confusion, those who lead all to liberation embody profound serenity. Going forward, all those in the past, present, and future who have this realization, who realize wisdom beyond wisdom, manifest unsurpassable and thorough awakening. They don't have it. They manifest it. They express it. They abide in it, like Avalokiteshvara was. And so we'll stop there and back up. If you happen to look at the Thich Nhat Hanh version that you've seen, he emphasizes in this movement to another shore, which is the stepping into wisdom beyond wisdom. That's what he's talking about. When he says, listen, Shariputra, kind of getting his attention, this body itself is emptiness. And emptiness itself is this body. This body isn't other than emptiness, and emptiness is not other than this body. The same is true for, and he lists the skandhas. And he says again, listen, Shariputra, you've got to really pay attention. All phenomena bear the mark of emptiness. Their true nature is the nature of no birth, no death, no being, no non-being, no defilement. He makes this list that everything has this nature of process rather than essence. And he says, so that's why in emptiness, body, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness are not separate self-entities. They're not things. They're processes. And then he goes on to refer to the lists in the Abhidharma that the Prajnaparamita teachings are going beyond. The 18 realms of phenomena, the six senses, the six sense objects, difficult to say, and the six consciousness are also separate, not self, separate self-entities. He's saying all these things that we've taken as separate aren't. And then he says the 12 links of interdependent arising and their extinction, which is freedom, are also not separate things, actually. ill-being, the causes of ill-being, the end of ill-being. That's actually the Four Noble Truths right there. The path, the Eightfold Path, insight and attainment are also not separate self-entities. So it sounds like in the Prajnaparamita Sutra, in the Heart Sutra, they're saying, we're going to toss out everything. None of that stuff actually is true. It's not what say, that, that's not what they're saying. In fact, the next line in the Thich Nhat Hanh version says, whoever can see this no longer needs anything to attain. We're not tossing out all the Buddhist teachings. What he says is, bodhisattvas who practice the insight that brings us to the other shore, in other words, bodhisattvas who practice wisdom beyond wisdom, see no more obstacles in their mind. And because there are no more obstacles in their mind, they can overcome fear and destroy all wrong perceptions and realize perfect nirvana or freedom. And all the Buddhas, the past, present, and future, who have practiced this insight that brings us to the other shore, are capable of attaining authentic and perfect enlightenment. So that's kind of running through some of this central teachings. I hope that you begin to see it a little bit different way. Because shunyata, or boundlessness, or emptiness, is not a negation or nihilism. It just suggests that everything is empty of individuality. So it actually points to this fullness. And it's not saying that there aren't any eyes or ears or nose, you know, and so on. It just suggests that when we open to the wisdom of emptiness, we don't see any difference among these things. If you rest back into pure awareness only, pure awareness isn't dependent on whether you can see or hear or smell or taste or touch. It's not dependent on what you see. It's not dependent on the meanings you make of it. It's just pure awareness. It doesn't move. It doesn't need to do anything. It has no preferences. And it's always with you. It's never apart from you. When people say to me, oh gosh, I don't know, I'm not having a very good meditation and I don't have any insight. I say, well, how do you know? Well, because, see, primary awareness is always there. So this nirvana is translated as profound serenity. But so many people think this like rests on like the annihilation of things. But nirvana is just the experience of shunyata, of emptiness, of fullness, of boundlessness, of indescribable freedom. And the sutra really strongly, almost ruthlessly says that your mind is not going to be able to hang on to this, and there's nothing you can actually attain, because guess what? There's nothing out there to cognize or attain. If spiritual knowledge or wisdom is reduced to some textual knowledge or learning that you could get, it goes against the spirit of everything the Buddha was teaching and trying to convey. A few exemplars, and I know that we're kind of coming to the end of our first hour. If you'll give me just a couple more minutes here. From history, Bodhidharma is the archetypal, maybe mythical figure that supposedly brought Buddhism from northern India into China. And he described Chan or Zen, which the lineage that we're following here is called. Someone asked, what is that? Excuse me. And Bodhidharma said, it's a special transmission outside the scriptures, without depending on words and letters, pointing directly to one's own mind, seeing into one's true nature and realizing Buddhahood. And that's what the Prajnaparamita's sutras and the Heart Sutra is pointing to. It's a special way of experiencing through practice something that's outside of anything you could describe, not depending on words and letters, but is pointing directly at the wisdom beyond wisdom, one's own mind with a capital M, not a thing. It's the vast empty process out of which everything arises and back to which everything will pass away. Some of you have heard the story of the sixth ancestor of Zen in China. We're just going kind of historically here a little bit, where the fifth ancestor wanted to choose a new person to become the next main ancestor carrying forward the tradition, because he was getting old, he knew he was going to die, and he decided to have a competition, have people write a poem, and he could see their understanding, and choose the person. Well, Hui Ning, who was an illiterate, who had come to the monastery because he'd heard someone chanting the Diamond Sutra and kind of woke up, he wasn't a monk. He wasn't even in the monastery per se. He was working, helping grind rice as one of the helpers to support the monastery. So the fifth ancestor decided to have this competition, and everyone posted their poems. And the head monk that everybody assumed would be the guy, you know, that would take over, wrote his poem. And this is one translation, very short. It said, "The body is the tree of wisdom. The mind, but a bright mirror, at all times diligently polish it to remain untainted by dust." It's a beautiful poem about everyday practice. This is what we practice with. The mind is a reflective consciousness. You want to polish it so it stays clear, untainted by the dust of delusion, whatever. Now, since Hui Ning couldn't read, he asked somebody secretly, "Would you read the poems to me?" And they did. And he said, "Okay, write this one down and post it next to the main monks." This is what he wrote. "The tree of wisdom fundamentally does not exist, nor is there a stand for the mirror. Originally, there's not a single thing, so where could dust alight?" And it's said in the old story or fable, maybe, that the fifth ancestor realized this is the highest teaching and realized that Hui Ning, who was illiterate, actually had the greater understanding and chose him as his disciple. And you can see that what Hui Ning is saying is the wisdom beyond wisdom teachings, taking everything beyond. The first one is a good, solid teaching, of course. In fact, here's a quote from Joko Beck you'll enjoy. In reflecting on this, she said, "While the verse of the sixth ancestor is the true understanding, the paradox for us is that we have to practice with the verse that was not accepted. We do have to polish the mirror. We do have to be aware of our thoughts and actions. We do have to be aware of our false reactions to life. Only by doing so can we see from the very beginning that the bottleneck of fear is an illusion. And it's obvious that we don't have to struggle to rid ourselves of an illusion, but we can't and won't know that unless we relentlessly polish the mirror." So she's saying what I said earlier about wisdom, about a relative and absolute compassion. You do have to practice. Practice doesn't create the wisdom beyond wisdom, but helps us see it. Helps us realize it. Because samsara is just a conceptual construct, just like nirvana. They're conceptual constructs. Nirvana is nothing more than like overcoming our self-imposed fear of samsara. But it isn't a thing in itself. And so in this understanding, both samsara and nirvana are both just processes. They're thereby making attaining nirvana impossible. But seeking to overcome the fear of samsara by finding refuge in nirvana is this dualistic approach, and it can't lead to the transcendent wisdom. So I know I need to stop, so I could say more about other things, but I think I'll just leave you with a short poem by by an American woman, a poet, Jane Hirschfield. The title of it is Against Certainty. It's not very long. She writes, there's something out in the dark that wants to correct us. Each time I think this, it answers that. Answers hard. In the heart, grammar's strictness. If I then say that, it too is taken away. Between certainty and the real, an ancient enmity. When the cat waits at the path edge, no cell of her body is not waiting. This is how she is able to so completely disappear. I would like to enter the silence portion as she does, to live amid the great vanishing, as a cat must live, one shadow fully at ease inside another. Kind of a beautiful image of what the Heart Sutra is pointing us to. So let's have some conversation. I hope I haven't gone on too terribly long. You're not too awfully bored.
You haven't. I'm not sure I want you to stop.
Oh gosh, well, I could go on, but no, I don't think that's a good idea. We will, because I think going on will be more fruitful if we do it in conversation.
Well, that's the other side of it. There's the desire to, for you just to carry on and just sort of bathe oneself in it. But we've learned as a Sangha that we often learn such a lot from each other and from just the questioning
right.
that we do, the talking we do. So in terms of pure practicalities, we had a talk at Sangha on Monday and talked about the difference between just open questioning, the way we'd have after a Dharma talk, using sure. we're on a retreat, sitting all in a room, just asking a question. And the difference from between that and inquiry, mm-hmm. Which is, and for those of us who haven't been on retreat, where a chair would come up and be put in front of you, and we would be invited to come up and ask a question, and that would be more of a dialogue.
It's so a little more intimate.
Say it.
A bit more intimate.
Yes, more intimate. More of a dialogue and ended slightly more formally. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to be able to have the luxury of both types of questions, if that's all right by you.
Sure.
So the way we're going to do it is that if people want to ask questions, they're going to put their hand up. Mm-hmm. And the way you do that. Does everybody know how to put their hand up?
Do you have the little hand icon? Or
yes, you
you
go
to reactions at the bottom
and look at reactions, and then if you go into reactions, you raise your hand. So I'm raising my hand at the moment. Can you see that little hand in my box?
Mm-hmm.
Everyone seen that? Yep. And now I'm lowering my hand. So if you wish to ask a question, then please just raise your hand. And then I'll try and do them in order and invite whoever it is to ask their question of Flint. Just to make things even more complicated, if you wish to have an inquiry sort of question, then if you can just put it in the chat box, my question is more of an inquiry. So that
you know, one other option to make it more complex, but maybe simpler. Yeah. If you raise your hand for a question, but in the reactions, there's this, which looks like you're applauding.
Oh, brilliant. Okay.
But we could assume it's a gusho, and that would be your say you want inquiry. Would that be okay?
Perfect. perfect. So raise hand for a normal one. And
the sideways gusho.
Sorry. We could have the crying one if you like.
No, we don't do that one.
Okay, let me put my hand down again. I've just put my own hand up.
Can I just say so, technically as well, that if you go for an inquiry, I will try and do the screens like this, but otherwise it's just going to go back to normal.
Yeah.
So it will just be a big group of us, unless it's inquiry, in which case it'll be the two people. So okay. Bridget has got her hand up.
She does.
Flint.
Hi, it's good to see you.
And you. Flint, two points that I would like to just ask you is when you talk about processes, coming perhaps from a quantum physics point of view, is this not perhaps an energy factor? Mm-hmm. That everything is about energy and emptiness and energy, I feel, are synonymous in a way.
Right. I mean, we're really speaking about that sort of mystical indeterminability between particle and wave. You know, it's like, is it a thing or is it a process? And you can't actually nail it down. And it's the larger view in which they have to be both held.
It's a reality that's not necessarily solid.
It's definitely not solid.
In which case, may I pursue this and say, do you believe then that there is power in prayer?
Oh, that's a really interesting. I don't disbelieve it. It's one of those things that you can't nail down any more than you could say, oh, this emptiness thing is like energy, because once again, we want to nail it down. We can't really. What I believe is that there is a transformational energy that comes along when you offer yourself in a devotional way towards something that is wholesome. There are unwholesome things you can devote yourself to. But if you offer yourself wholesome, like in prayer, for example, for the benefit of yourself or a loved one or someone, then you're orienting yourself towards something. Who knows about the magic of, does it make a difference? It does make a difference in this. And if this is not separate from that,
absolutely, thank you. And my mm-hmm. second point was that if I were to posit that there is a link between the great religions of the world, who perhaps at one time had some intuitive knowledge and awareness of how and why we exist as human beings, then I would just offer that, because I was brought up in a Anglican church, my mm-hmm. father was a clergyman, but the most meaningful part of the service for me was, may the peace of God, which passeth all understanding, be with you now and always, mm-hmm. has always been, not just because it's the end of the service and I can go home and eat, but the most powerful part of the sermon and service for me, because it's the which passeth all understanding, by which I know that means it's not a logical, human, existential sort of factual, solid reality. And I think there's a link.
And so say the phrase again.
May the peace of God, which passeth all understanding, be with you now and always.
Right. It's really the same benediction, isn't it, that's in the Heart Sutra.
Absolutely.
It's like the wisdom beyond wisdom that you can't understand.
Yes.
That comes from some original source. May it stay with you. Actually, it can't not. You know, we didn't talk about the, I forgot to talk about the mantra. That was the third one. There was the invocation. We better talk about that for a second. Is that okay?
Yeah, please.
Okay. Well, the mantra, as you know, is, you know, gate, gate, paragate, parasamgati, purisvaha. Okay. One of my friends one time said, by the end of a long retreat, I say, latte, latte, bring me a latte. Bring me a latte with full cream. Kind of silly. But the translation that is used in the Thich Nhat Hanh version, I'm going to make sure I get it here clearly. He says the translation is arriving, arriving, arriving all the way together, awakening and joy. So he's talking about gate gate being the arriving on the other shore, arriving, arriving. The more classical translation I prefer because it points to the wisdom beyond wisdom. And the classical translation is gone, gone, gone beyond, gone beyond even beyond. And then Bodhisattva is like far out. It's like this takes you beyond the ordinary, beyond even that. It's the wisdom beyond wisdom. Therefore, no matter what translation you use, Thich Nhat Hanh talks about arriving on the other shore. The classical translation talks about going across. But you could, I would say that the mantra really is about homage to the awakened mind, which has gone over to the other shore. And because it's an invocation of the, it's like a little prayer. And mantras are like sacred formulas and sounds, which could offer, you know, energies or protection. They're not things to understand. But they don't appeal to the intellect, but they the energetic resonance carries you forward in some way. And this one is for Prajnaparamita, or there's six paramitas. Prajnaparamita is the paramita of wisdom, which makes all the others possible. So that's just a little bit about the mantra. And did we finish, Bridget? Is that okay?
Yes, thank you very much. Yes.
Okay, I see Sally has her hand up.
And I think that Sarah.
Okay, you have the list. I'm sorry.
Oh. The other hand, but she's been waving. Sarah, did you want to ask a question?
Yes, please.
Okay, then Sally. Sorry, Sally.
It's so good to see these faces and hear these voices I've seen and heard before.
It's so good to see you, Flynn. This isn't really a question, more of a beautiful compliment, really, because I think very visually. I'm an artist, and sometimes I find, you know, pages and pages of text quite complicated to process. But when you, for the last hour, for me, you've made everything come alive in 3D.
That's my Flint hand signals.
I talk to. So thank you. It's just wonderful to hear someone who can speak visually in such a, you know, remarkable way. So
well, you know, one of the things that is true about me is I actually find these things exciting, you know, and beautiful, and I really get into it. And so I start gesturing, and I want to make sure that it's like my form of sign language, I guess. But I'm glad that it translates in some way.
It does indeed. It's great. And it makes me have faith in myself, because that's what I do. And a lot of people just sort of don't understand what I'm doing. So,
that's good. Well, I want you to imagine with me for a moment. I think you'll appreciate this. Some of you may have heard it. One of the most, I love visual arts and graphic arts and calligraphy. And there was a piece of calligraphy that was in the hallway at the San Francisco Zen Center I just adored. It was my favorite ever. And it wasn't a little square with a kanji, you know, symbol. It was a strip, literally about this high, but about a meter wide. And it was an expression of what we're talking about. The character was for thusness or suchness. If that, and but the way it was done, and I'll do it physically, it was like on the piece of paper with the brush, it was done like this. And so most of the piece of paper was the with just the symbol on the side. Because when you looked at it, you got it.
Yeah. This is so lovely to hear you talk. And it's like a film.
Mm-hmm.
Coming through, you know, coming into.
Excuse me for a moment. I'm going to get something for you. You know how the classic image in Zen of form and emptiness is the inso?
Yeah.
And they're so beautifully and perfectly done with the black ink and just a little break. So here's my preference. And this is done by Kaz Tanahashi, the person.
Is that the red one? Is it all the red ones? Yeah. Yeah, I've seen that before when you've had it on the wall.
Oh, yeah, yeah, you said it on the wall.
That was made by a whole load of different people, but it was...
Yeah, that one. But I liked it because it was so alive.
Yeah. I thought this would be a really great idea to, in a sitting when you're actually allowed to be with other people, please, God, let it happen soon. But you could give everybody a brush with some red paint and to do one, you know. Anyway.
Thanks for your comments and our conversation.
Lali?
Hi.
Hello.
Lovely to see you.
It's great to see you, and I know exactly where you are, and I wish I was sitting in that room with you.
You do, and we're missing you, but it's lovely to see you. I don't know if, I've no idea if this is like a question or an inquiry or what it is, but shall I just ask it anyway?
Please.
Okay. It's to do with, you said something about, a lot of talk about turning towards another's suffering. And well, you know me well enough, just in the little time you spent, you know, I like to look on the bright side.
Mm-hmm.
And recently we've been having, we can do paired walking in this country, which is how we're managing our connection with people. And actually it wasn't true with my walk with Lorraine today, but in the past, and actually when I spend a bit of time with people, I realize that I kind of need to learn more to turn towards another's suffering. Because I think what I do is I quickly try to change the subject or kind of to avoid it. Mm-hmm. And I just wondered, and I love the idea of sort of finding a middle way that's together. And I think I do that to protect myself from the experience of suffering. And I know, you know, what you've been talking about today, it isn't that I have to experience another's suffering. It's to do with just being with them,
just being open to it.
Being open to it. And I just wondered if you had any hints for me on how I might do that, because I kind of almost do it without even thinking about it. And then I kind of reflect later on and go, gosh, they were telling me something. And I realize I stopped kind of I didn't let them finish it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was about protecting myself, I know. Do you know what I'm saying?
I do know what you're saying, and you've done the most important and necessary, it's not sufficient, but it's necessary, primary practice, which is you're aware of what you're doing.
Mm.
You've waked up to it. You're not just blithely going along thinking it's just what to do. Mm. There's some part of you that went, there's something not complete, or there's something not quite right about this.
Mm.
Now, I would say that if you're the kind of person, and you are, I know you well enough, that you tend to look towards what's right or what's good, and you don't dwell on what's wrong, not that you don't see it, but you don't dwell there, And this is like my friend, the photographer DeWitt Jones, who has a whole thing called Celebrating What's Right with the World. And in his TED talk, he said, I'm not a Pollyanna. I'm not just trying to make everything look shiny and pretty. By noticing what's good and right and amazing in the world, that gives me the energy and the nourishment to hang with the stuff that's difficult.
Okay.
It's a source of nourishment. So this is one of the gifts you have by your particular inclination, if you don't let it run amok. Mm. Your inclination is to look what's good and what's positive. Do that. That fuels you to manage facing, as long as you don't change it into fixing.
Yeah.
Just facing what's more difficult. And the primary tool for that is curiosity. Not problem solving. Just go to curiosity.
Mm. I think
someone says something, it's like, oh, really? Tell me more about that. Mm. Without any sense that you have to do anything about it.
I think that's the thing. I think for me, it's something to do with, I mean, I don't want to spend a lot of time because I'm sure lots of people have got lots of questions, but it's something about feeling kind of rather porous, that I will somehow also be feeling that person's suffering and feeling their, you know, suffering myself.
It will touch you. You're right. You have to be willing to be touched.
Yeah.
But if as you practice and you feel this larger wisdom beyond wisdom, we're talking about that kind of larger compassion, you'll realize that what they're talking about, the story is not your story.
Yeah.
Particular thing isn't yours, but you know that suffering from your own life, and it's that resonance that gets set up, which is the gift that keeps your heart open and gives them a sense of someone's with them. Now if you just take it on and begin to think you've got to do something, that's the crushing burden. One of the practices that we often do in retreat is we'll actually have people do paired walks. And you've done this, I think, timed for like 15 minutes. One person can speak about whatever they want to speak about. The other person cannot speak at all. They just listen. But they're not just like waiting for the person. They're actively listening. And then there's a switch, and the second person will speak, and the first person doesn't say anything. Then you have a third 15 minutes where you can converse. But things go differently when there's just attentive listening without any interruption or redirection before you talk. So you might practice that with your friends.
Right.
And you can say, let's just have a good time, an ordinary talk. But sometime you might say, well, do you want to do the practice and see what it's like? And then as you notice your habit pattern, and as you notice the way that you're attempting to experiment with this habit pattern, just notice what you learn. It's an experiment. Just get the data. See what you learn.
Okay.
Does that satisfy the question?
Yes. Good. Thanks. Yes. That's lovely.
You might want to put your hand down so we can.
I will.
If you go to the little thing.
I will. How do I do that? Oh, there we are. Okay.
Thank
you. Next. Someone is next, Kate. You're muted.
Sorry.
Lorraine?
I said it. It's Lorraine next.
Okay. Thank you.
Got you.
So, a couple of quick questions, Flint, if I may. Thank you. I found it very helpful when you explained that boundlessness or being empty I found that much easier to relate to.
It's not nothing.
Emptiness. Yeah.
Yeah. It's so, not nothing.
So my question is, because I know we've debated a lot, two of us here have a Theravadan background, and yes. You know, debated a lot about translation from Pali, obviously, but I wondered if there was a deliberate selection of the word emptiness.
I don't know.
Whether you think it was...
Emptiness is the classical translation of shunyata that's been used in all the literature and Buddhism mostly. I mean, it's really ubiquitous. It's not just in that San Francisco Zen Center version of the Heart Sutra. It's really everywhere. And the innovation to use boundlessness, which is really quite defensible from a translation point of view, was an innovation, I think, that lands differently, as you said.
Mm. You know, like that image of the hand pointing is not what it's pointing to.
Right.
You know, the hand that we see pointing.
Right.
I wondered if the selection of emptiness was deliberately obtuse, because it feels...
I don't think so. I think it was an attempt just to have a one-word translation of a word, shunyata, that you can't translate in one word. And that's why I said it's a kind of a shorthand for empty of individual existence, empty of individuality. But I don't think there was some attempt to make it difficult. I think that the understanding of what emptiness implies here is part of the work of practice. And that's why when you begin to go into the nuances, it's like, oh, we're not talking about emptiness as a thing. The form is the expression of emptiness. It's not empty. Emptiness is process, not it's not nominalized as a thing. And that's hard to do in the translation.
Yeah, so it's also something about it being a noun in English, isn't it? Mm-hmm. That it becomes a fixed thing.
Yeah, it sounds like another thing in a way.
Yeah, thank mm-hmm. you. And my second question was a bit related to sounds, really, which is I get a bit lost in all this. As you know, as much as I love the Dharma, mm-hmm. I find I reach a point where my bafflement sort of puts me off, really, because it feels like an intellectual challenge, you know.
Sure.
So I loved it when you described, because I'm essentially sort of practical person, how if you approach compassion from a dualistic sense of self, or you know, understanding of how the world is, that you're likely to that's likely to take effort and you're likely to feel exhausted. And you talked about finding the middle way between the absolute and the relative. And I wondered if you could explain that again, because I didn't understand fully what you meant by the absolute and the relative.
Oh, okay. By the absolute, I'm talking about the compassion, almost like the compassion of God or something, you know, this big, big, big compassion, understanding the unity of everything. And it's the way that one would see the world that isn't about particularity. It's the love of the universe when you become attendant to this whole vast universal love. It's universal love. Mm-hmm. And relative compassion is personal love, individual love. I have to roll up my sleeve and love someone that has a story and is here and is walking with Sally, apparently. And, you know, that's not some big, because if we go, Ram Dass once said, if you get too far out, you lose your humanity. And if you get too caught in, you lose your divinity. And we're actually both. That there's this two ways we tend to look at things because we have a dualistic mind. The wisdom beyond wisdom says, that's just the way reality looks because we have a dualistic mind. It's not the way it is. And so we want to have the larger view because it gives us the deep understanding that everything is going to be okay and that we have the whole universe on our side. Doesn't not going to work out how we want it to work out. That's not what I mean by okay. Everything is going to go like it's going. So we can rest in that. And then practicing gives us a capacity, like Sally was saying, to turn toward with some curiosity and open heart, an individual who's right there, a warm flesh and blood human being, that we can actually do something and make a difference for ourselves and somebody else. And so these are just two ways of looking at the one experience that's happening. Am I responding to your question?
Yes, I think so. Thank you.
Yeah. The best description of this that I've ever read is in a book that you have used there, I think. There's a segment in here about relative and absolute compassion that's brilliant.
Okay.
And explains that. And so many people are shaking their head, they can probably lead you to it. I'm not sure which. Oh, it's on page like 14 and 15 and 16, somewhere in there. I have it marked because it's so good, I go to it. You know?
Thank you.
Okay. Tony, do you want to ask your question next?
Hi, Tony.
Hello, Flint. Yeah, I've been working recently with the mantra abandon hope, which comes from Pema Chodron. Mm-hmm. And my understanding of it is to do with attuning to how things are. Nothing's missing, nobody going anywhere, let go, be at peace, not always have a sort of grasping, attaining angle on things. Mm-hmm. And in the Heart Sutra, it says, with nothing to attain this, and then with nothing to attain that. So that seems to be in harmony with there's nothing to attain.
Yes.
What I'm left with is what happens to right effort in all of this.
Oh, that's
in terms of where, having got to the point where you're not trying to get anywhere, you still have to get out of bed, sit on your cushion, keep going, act with good intention, keep the precepts if that's your inclination.
Sure.
So can you say something about right effort?
Sure. You're doing a pretty good job yourself in a way.
Where are you? There you are.
It's a ditch you can fall into. If you read the Heart Sutra text, say, oh, there's nothing to attain, so why bother? No, there's nothing, there's no thing that you're going to attain, but there is attainment that is the actualization of what you realize. And when you realize that you are deeply and profoundly interconnected with everything, that realization naturally propels you to ethical and compassionate action, because it's you that you're helping. Because there's none other than you, because everything's connected. And so it's not like, oh, there's nothing to attain, so don't worry about it. No, there's nothing to attain. No worry is needed, but you'll naturally come forward and operate in the world in an ethical way. But you don't have to struggle with attainment. It's a poor analogy, but one that helps me, is when I think about how to become a really good jazz musician. You know, whatever instrument you choose, you're going to have to do the really hard, long, laborious work of learning that instrument and playing the scales, doing the mantras, doing the sitting over and over and over and over and over, so that you become one with your instrument. You don't have to think about it, because you're not trying to attain something. If you start trying to attain the song, you start thinking about it, it doesn't go very well. That's like trying to attain an orgasm. It really doesn't work very well. You have to let go, you know, and immerse yourself in the experience. And then a jazz musician has the capacity, if you're with other people in an improvisational setting, someone plays a few chords and you can begin to play with them and it sounds like music and not just banging away, because you've disciplined yourself. But it's not attaining something. Something flows. That's another thing. So I don't know if it's a very good metaphor, but maybe it touches. Then something magical happens and you can feel it and it touches other people, but it's nothing you can grasp. But it came out of the hard, practical, everyday work in the beginning to become one with and non-separation from your other, you know, people you're in your improvisational group with. Same with voices. You know, there's a lot of ways you can think about it.
I think you hit a perfect metaphor there.
Okay. In fact, the work of a bodhisattva, our teacher, Peter Hershock, who actually lives in Honolulu, has written some wonderful things. He calls awakening improvisational virtuosity. You're a virtuoso at improvisation of meeting what comes to you with ease and freedom. So did I respond to your question okay? Anything left over?
Well, only that it's a mysterious process. I mean, you describe it beautifully and it's lovely when it happens. And
it is mysterious.
I understand what I understand, but there is a whole aspect to it which unfolds without any agency.
That's right. And if we could nail it down, it would lose its magic and it wouldn't be that anymore. And so when we talk about abandoning hope, it's not about having no hope. It's abandoning hope as a refuge from doing what Kate was saying and what, well, more what Sal was talking about being able to meet what's in front of us as it is, instead of resting on hope. I actually have somewhere in my blog, there's a little piece that's entitled Hope is Cruel.
That's good.
Yeah, because it really is about attachment. And refuge is different than hope. Taking refuge. Taking refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha.
Thank you.
And the tea ceremony idea of focusing on all the imperfections of life is a valuable starting point. I really recognize I'm far from perfect, but I recognize every day that whatever troubles me or is a problem is my starting point. And I do believe that peace and serenity can be achieved in any moment. And I did with Sal.
My question is, it's an inquiry type question, but I've discovered that if you put up clapping hands, they disappear after 30 seconds.
Oh. Thank you so much.
Didn't know that.
So it's slightly inquiry-like, but it doesn't...
It's impermanent.
the first thing I wanted to say, thank you so much for sharing Kaz Tanahashi's translation or interpretation of the Heart Sutra. Like Lorraine, I found that concept of talking about boundlessness really liberating, actually. It really makes a lot of the thinking really clear, because, you know, what are boundaries? They're not real. They're sort of expedient things that we put in to between this and that as what it is and what it isn't. And it also made me feel that it starts to explain a little bit between this two sides of the coin thing, form and emptiness, because Jñāna is the, if it's the boundless quality of beings and things, hence it manifests itself through the very existence of the beings and the things. So you can't have Jñāna without beings and things, and you can't have valid beings and things without Jñāna.
That's right.
Whoa, that was really exciting. Thank you.
Yeah, boundlessness, I think the shift there, I think makes all the difference in really it coming alive.
Yeah. But brings me on to my question, which is that I have been sitting now for nearly 5 years. Was it over 5 years?
You've been what?
Sitting, practicing.
Practicing, uh-huh.
Studying, whatever.
Yes.
And the more I immerse myself in the Dharma, the more it speaks. But a wee bit like it segues from Tony's question, really. I find that equally it becomes more of a challenge to embody that teaching. I get why we sit. And it was such a joy watching the San Francisco Zen teachers talk about Suzuki Roshi's book, because God, they just embody the whole thing. But it feels as if I understand more. And when I read it, I think, whoa, that's incredible. And then I go out into the street and I'm a cow to someone. And it's really hard. I know how you're going to answer this question, but how do you bring that embodiment? How do you start to embrace that embodiment, that wonderful joy of the Dharma, and actually becoming that sort of person?
And how am I going to answer?
You're going to say, just sit, aren't you?
The boundlessness of awakening let's do it a different way. Let yourself rest for a moment. And just the embodied experience of boundlessness. And so I'm going to speak to you as if I could speak to boundlessness directly. Okay? And this is super simple. It's not rocket science. This is like really basic. Okay? So let yourself just sit like you're sitting in Zazen for a moment. You're boundlessness, okay? Now, who are you? Go ahead and just answer. You're boundlessness. Make it simple.
Boundlessness.
You're boundlessness, okay? How big are you?
Boundless.
What do you contain?
Everything.
What is it that you exclude?
Nothing.
What happens to Kate?
She expands.
She's in you and expressed as you. So just back to you and me. You can probably feel a little shift just by embodying that for a moment. Yeah. That means that when what you call being a cow to someone on the street, that's included. If you have a practice that's the practice of purification or perfection, it's a problem. If you have a practice of boundlessness and inclusion, you have a direction. Now, it doesn't mean you don't pay attention to the difficulties. That's what the precepts are for. Of course you do. And you have an aspiration. And then when you come back to sit, your sitting isn't an all-out effort to be one of those good people. Your sitting is a small ceremony to express the boundlessness that you just claimed you were. So you sit upright and you open to boundlessness, which may feel like closeness. It may feel like sleepiness, may feel like anger, may feel like a confused mind. All that's included in boundlessness, right? But you sit upright and you express it with your body. That your Buddha nature is what you are, even as form shows itself in all these varied ways. And over time, there's a and you still end up being Kate. Each person is, it's about becoming yourself, but your deeper self, not just your whatever self. This is a kind of a freedom, but not the freedom that says I get to do whatever I want. It's free of all of your habits and conditioning, so that that boundlessness flows through you just with more ease. You become a larger container with less constriction. This is the spiritual stint to keep your heart blood flowing. So what's your experience at this moment now?
I feel very huge.
Good.
I feel very, that all of us, I just feel huge. I feel as if it's all of us.
And without changing your posture or where you're looking or anything, it would be easy to reach over and touch your husband. Just hold hands. Don't look, just keep looking at me, but just touch. And feel the personalness next to the boundlessness without going back and forth.
Doesn't stop the boundlessness.
Right. That's right. But that doesn't mean you can't reach and touch. No. They happen at the same time, through the same vehicle.
Thank you.
When you hear, some of you have said some things, I want to use this word. I am the way, the truth, and the light. So you should use the way part, because that's similar to Buddhism or Taoism. So now sit as the way. Who are you?
I'm the way.
Can the way reach and touch your husband?
Yes.
Can the way see onto the screen?
Yes.
Can the way speak?
Yes.
If I asked you, could the way stand up and turn around and walk outside? Yeah, the way is everything.
Joe is next.
Hi, Joe. You're muted still. There you go.
Am I unmuted?
You Hello. Are. Hello, good to see you.
Good to see you. This, when I start talking, it might just be a very confused question, or whether it is even a question. So it kind of links with various people, and maybe it's a question for everyone. I think it's... the whole world, we all collectively are in grief of everything that we're going through. Mm-hmm. I grieve my aunt and uncle and not being able to sort of hold them and be held. And I think talking about, what was I writing down? I guess my question is, there's, you know, it goes back to the beginning where you're saying this whole stuff is kind of energy. We're all feeling it, and it feels so heavy. And I've continued to work for the last year, and I still am, and I see people, and I'm speaking to people all the time, but the sadness, and I know, like my aunt, I'm quite porous to other people's energies, and, you know, and I want to take it on my shoulders. It's not about me trying to save other people, but I guess what I'm trying to find out is, in the kind of going beyond the ordinary, going to the other shores, not just aiming for this and da 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 da, and trying to hold people without actually physically being able to hold them. How do you kind of, I've not been going to the Sangha, I've not been joining in, I have read Training in Compassion, but I'm not practicing. And that's probably, it probably is the answer to what I'm trying to say, is how do you get the calm to just be in this grief-filled world where we can't we just, you know, we talk about boundlessness, but actually the whole world is bound. It's funny looking at this screen, you know, we're all in these boxes. This is, we're all in these four walls and we do what we can do, but it's how do you...
Those are those two truths we've been talking about.
Hmm.
If you truly love someone and there's some loss or break, you're going to feel grief and pain.
Yeah.
And your grief and your pain is the testament to your love. It would be strange not to feel it. Boundlessness suggests that you are free to feel the pain, not free from the pain.
No. Okay.
You're free to grieve. You're free to long to be there. You're and free to express it and still willing to just live life as it is. But you're free to have a full human life, not free from it.
But we're not free at the moment. We're so...
We're not talking about everyday freedom. I'm talking about the larger freedom that you would feel free to feel grief and express it.
Yeah.
To Sally or, you know, to David. And not freedom to go see them. You don't have that. But you'd be free to feel the feelings.
Yeah.
That's why Nelson Mandela could be free in those 20-something years in his cell. Yes, was he bound? Of course he was. Was he free? Completely.
Yeah.
They happened at the same time. And so this is our year of monastic practice.
Mm-hmm.
Of being, Suzuki Roshi said, being in a retreat, or and this was like being a snake in a bamboo tube. It's like you're forcing yourself to be rigid in a place that doesn't actually fit your the way you were made. But what you learn is every way that you wiggle, all the ways you try not to accept reality, and what it means to be a full human being with all of your feelings, with people that you love. And practice doesn't mean that you don't have that stuff. It means you're more free doing it and feeling it and moving through it.
Yeah.
So it's not the freedom to get to do what you want. It's the freedom to continue to live fully and with more energy, even when you can't get what you want.
Mm.
That practicing will not make your life more pleasant. It will make it completely possible.
Yeah. It's funny because the first time I met you was, I think, in Cookfield.
Yeah.
And I did inquiry with you. And what came out then was this, a kind of not feeling free because you feel often... like you blame yourself. There's a lot of blame in the world. And I think because I'm, to an extent, I've not been locked in my house. I've gone to work. I've, you know, mm-hmm. I've been alone most of that time, but I've continued to do what I do. When I can't help other people and I can just feel it coming, it's not that I want to take away other people's pain, but I think sometimes I'm not very good at making phone calls and speaking to people. So like just to be there or to do a nice act, to just go and sit and have a cup of tea with someone or to have a walk, or I think that's, and it feels, I think I feel like, why can't I do more? But I guess.
Well, this is the thing, you could do more. Accept your limitations.
Yeah.
And know that you're not going to do as much as you would hope. Mm. Because if you free yourself from the pressure and the guilt or the worry, whatever wants to happen can actually move more easily.
Yeah.
And you'll actually be more generous. But as long as you're criticizing yourself for not doing enough, not going to move very easily.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Lint, we've come to the end of our time.
I see that.
Tom has a question and Bridget has another question. Do we have time for a question?
I do. Yeah.
Tom.
Hi, Flint. First time I've met you.
Oh, there he is. Hi, Tom.
Yes, I've been very, very inspired by what you're saying. And what I'm asking is truly sincere.
Yes.
But, I remember in a personal development course being told understanding is the booby prize. And I also remember in a previous time when I was looking into Buddhism, the local guy who was running the Sangha invited me to his house, and I said, oh great, we can spend an evening talking about Buddhism and metaphysics and all that. He said, yes, we could spend the evening exchanging opinions. And so I sort of wonder, what is the purpose of the Sangha? And also, what is the purpose of this evening?
Yeah, do you recognize a meaning or a purpose in it?
I guess it's, I sort of feel it's not necessarily understanding.
No, it's not understanding. You won't remember most of what I said, and I don't care. That's not important. But you remember the feeling of what it's like to be together. And the next time you chant the Heart Sutra, will it be a little bit more alive? The Sangha is the most essential. There's an old teaching story. I don't know if you've heard it, where Ananda, you know, the Buddha's cousin who supposedly remembered all the teachings and wrote them down, was talking to the Buddha and trying to understand this question, Sangha, what's the deal? And finally, Ananda says in the scriptures, in the Pali Canon, you can read it. He says, oh, I get it. This is way bigger than I thought. It's like at least half of the practice. And the Buddha says, no. It's the whole thing. It's all intimately weaving our hearts and lives together. We refer to the Dharma, the way things work. And we refer to the Buddha, our own, not the Buddha, our own Buddha nature in the process. We reveal it to each other and come to understand it as we look at each other and speak to each other and help each other and fail each other and repair these things. But it's only through human interaction that any of this makes any sense. Otherwise, it's just an interesting hobby or an intellectual pursuit, which is like, I guess it's fun, but there's a lot more fun things to do. And it's why, this is a whole nother talk, of why people will be drawn to very unwholesome things, like you've seen in the United States recently, for example. Because when you're despairing of meaning and connection, you'll do things that are quite crazy, because it's better than being alone and not feeling like your life matters. And this is a wholesome way to be together that can shift our energies in an ethical and wholesome way, not to be good, but to be real and present. And so anyway, those are the ways I think about it. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Pretty good.
And that's why, for example, you're asking a question is a gift, because it invites everyone to pay attention and listen, and we hear something. But it's not about an opinion. I'm not trying to convince anybody of anything. I'm trying to immerse us in an experience in which things can be revealed to each other, and especially our beauty. So, thank you.
Bridget.
You're muted.
Sorry. I really only wanted to say how much I appreciate Lorraine, Sal, David, Kate, Rob, for all the work that they do in terms of being our guidance and help out there in the real world. And I understand that the pressures of that filter will inevitably filter their concept of connecting with every single person, because every day I know that I am not the great and wonderful giver or compassionate person, but I'm doing the little that I can, and I just wanted to let them all know that they're very much appreciated by me, because I can't speak for Sarah, but I can say as an artist that it's easy for me to be a part of the conscious whole. So much more easy than it is than if I were filtered through some business, occupation, whatever. As an artist, I can be and express who I am, and I do touch. Occasionally, I touch that sense of egolessness and egolessness. And I understand that in the real world, it's not so easy, but every day presents me with challenges that I recognize. And I think that you are doing such wonderful work for us all. And Tony, I'm absolutely with you too. I can't imagine what it is like to be in your situation. Can't imagine. But it's not that I'm without consciousness.
And yeah. It's all the real world. It's all real.
Yeah.
And thank you for your gratitude. I think that I saw on your list of things that we were to end with a Bodhisattva vow.
Yes.
And Greta, who is our wonderful, you know, is going to lead us in that. But just to say a final thank you. And thank you, Flint. It, as always, it's inspiring and it's wonderful. But thank you to the entire Sangha.
Thanks for having me. It's been really wonderful.
Can we do it again sometime?
Sure.
And over to you.
There'll be other opportunities online that other sanghas are sponsoring that you can also chime in on too.
Lovely.
So we'll need to mute ourselves for the chanting so Zoom doesn't go crazy, right? But we'll chant along with...
Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. Beings are numberless. We vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. We vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. We vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. We vow to become it. Beings are numberless. This vow saves them all. Delusions are inexhaustible. This vow ends them all. Dharma gates are boundless. This vow enters them all. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. This vow embodies it.
Since we beautiful, thank you.
Well, thank you, Flint. It's just been fantastic. I found all the time you were answering questions that I was going to ask. I especially resonated with me what you said to Kate. I was going to have a similar question. Where am I in all this? Mm-hmm. Now I got a little inkling of where I might be.
Charlotte, can I just say thank you for joining us from Canada? It feels very weird to... You have you in the same room as us. I wish you were with us, but thank you for joining us.
I'm in the middle of a polar vortex, which is even more exciting.
It's good to be able to feel warmth from the midst of a polar vortex via the joys of the internet. And lovely to, we've been looking at compassion and Norman Fisher's book in the Calgary Sangha. And it was really wonderful when you pointed out Avalokiteshvara's status. I didn't realize that this was the figure of compassion. It makes so much sense. And so apparently the San Francisco Zen Center was arguing about, you know, bringing in the loving kindness meditation to bring more of a focus on compassion, but now I realize it was always there. So thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yes, in terms of since we're talking about translation, what we've done is we've shifted beings are numberless, I vow to free them. Because it's a little more spacious.
Mm.
And then in the last line, Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow, we vow, we use embody it. Mm. Instead of become it, embody it, because it's a little more visceral and not just sort of in. And you said it in the third one, but I think it's good to use that. This is a rather strange little thing. If you want to see and hear what it's like in a traditional Zen temple to chant the Heart Sutra in Japanese, I have a little 3-minute video if you want to see it.
Yes.
But it's done in a way that also expresses universality, which is what we want. So let me see if I can cue it up here properly. And of course, you know what it's like on these crazy things. You have to, I'm gonna mute myself for a second in case it makes the, you know, an ad before the thing on the internet. So let me see if I can share my screen. Okay, can you see that?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Without the music. But I thought it was lovely.
Yeah.
To hear it, you know, and to see all the different, and there were many people from, there are people in there I know, you know, people from the West, from the United States and things. It was just nice. So I'll say goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.